Well, hello everybody, and welcome to our Catholic News podcast. Now, today we're taking a close look at palliative care, social care, and what needs to be fixed. We have a particularly good guest with us to do this, Dr. Karen Groves, MBE, who set up a hospice in Southport in the Northwest. Karen, good to have you with us. How are you?
Thank you. Fine. Good to be with you.
Perfect. Now, look, talking about that wonderful hospice, you founded Queen's Court some 30, 35 years ago when there were no real palliative care services in West Lancashire, Formby, Southport, where you are. Tell us a bit about Queen's Court Hospice and how you serve the local community.
Okay. Indeed, I qualified at a time when the modern hospice and palliative care movement was only just beginning. That shows how old I am. And my sister, who is a nurse, and I found that pain and other symptoms were really poorly managed, not due to lack of compassion or care, but just through lack of knowledge. And that there was a lot of fear amongst the public and health professionals about the use of morphine and also of speaking to people about their illness and what to expect in the future. It just wasn't done in those days. We've moved on a lot in nearly 50 years, and now for this area, we've got integrated hospice and specialist palliative care services working out of Queen's Court, which is our local hospice, the specialist clinical and educational hub, seeing patients and families in Queen's Court itself, or an equal number in our local hospitals, and twice as many again in our local care homes and their own homes, which is where the vast majority of people really want to be living their lives and living them to the full, to the end, whenever that might be.
And that's a lot of prongs to the approach, isn't it? And I know we talked off mic a bit about, you know, continuity of care through those structures. Is that a real challenge, joining those up and making sure A speaks to B, speaks to C, speaks to D?
It is. It's a huge challenge. But it's taken many years of work to build relationships with all other local services. And those are really important so that everything's knitted together. And that provides the continuity of care. It's made a big difference to the number of people who are able to stay in their own homes because, you know, some people accuse hospices of providing a gold standard service to a very few. And I would counter that to say that where hospices have the opportunity to develop integrated services across all settings, then actually they can provide a responsive, helpful, reliable, and consistent service in which patients and families have confidence, and they're much less likely to dial 999 because of fear or not knowing what to do in a situation. It makes a big difference.
So sort of holistically, that serves the whole system. It doesn't sort of bottleneck it in places. People feel a bit more assured that, you know, when they do avail themselves of a service, it will be the right one at the right time for them with their particular
Yes.
symptoms and conditions. So this might lead on to that quite nicely, but what are those factors to help you achieve gold standard palliative care and end of life care?
I think there are many, but a few of the main ones, I think, are investment in selection, ongoing training, and real support of skilled clinical and non-clinical staff. And then time and attention to detail for every patient and family. That's really important. A huge number of committed volunteers without whom the service couldn't provide the standard of care that it does. And then the financial support and goodwill of the community of this area, West Lancashire, Southport and Formby, who've supported the building, the growth and the development of their services. These belong to them. And then, as you said, good working relationships and communication with other services, hospitals, community, care homes, to ensure that no patient is left between services. And on top of all of that, an education service which is there for all professionals, formal and informal carers, and the public, which helps to ensure a good standard of palliative and end-of-life care to be consistent across all settings. There are lots more, but, you know, those are the main ones.
No, that's very clear. But I particularly like, Karen, to be honest, that it's not a them and us, is it? The way you talk, it's not here are the care professionals over here in rather a sanitized fashion where we meet needs and treat things. And over here, you've got Joe Public, the community. I love the way you're bringing that together. There's not a divide.
I think it's really important to remember that 90% of people's last year of life is spent at home. 90% of the care is given by their own families and friends. That's really important. And we're there to help to support that, not to take it over.
So in a way, do you see them as part of the team, as it
Of
were?
course. Of course. They are the team. We're just the additions.
So, Karen, there is that feeling that people do go to a hospice to die. Is that right?
Not really. There are some hospices which are nursing homes for the terminally ill and will admit people for that. But the vast majority of specialist palliative care units, which is what our hospice is there to admit people for short stay, usually an average of about 9 days, for crisis intervention, symptom control, to sort things out and get people back home again. And in fact, in the last 25 years, which is when I've been looking at the statistics, the number of people living and dying in hospital 25 years ago in this area was three-fifths of those who died, with two-thirds dying in their usual place of residence. Now that has been turned upside down, and approximately three-fifths of people remain in their usual place of residence and two-fifths in hospital. That's a big turnaround.
Yeah, absolutely.
Most people want to be at home.
Well, look, I've got to ask that question about finance because it doesn't come for free. But I do know how they're financed, but I'd like to hear it from you because you know better. How are hospices financed to cope with, the deficits, the pressure to cut services, that existential threat?
So finance for all hospices varies, but it has similarities. For Queen's Court ourselves, 24% of our funding comes from governmental sources, mainly via the NHS. But 76 of our 7 million annual running costs has to be raised from local people by a small fundraising team every year through donations, grants, legacies, events, coffee mornings, all the other sorts of things. And after 40 years of fundraising, this is getting more and more difficult as government funding has not risen with inflation. Increased employer national insurance contributions and energies and supplies costs have been crippling. Annual average legacy income has reduced from 1.25 million a year to £250,000. Reduced high street footfall has affected retail income from hospice shops, and other very worthy charitable fundraising in the town has had a huge impact. The government's made many tranches of money available over the years, indeed some recently, but this is always restricted to capital costs. They're one-off tranches, refurbishment, rebuilding, and those sorts of things. It's not allowed to be used for running costs, which is really what is most needed.
No, absolutely. And I'm really struck by what you said about the legacies, what people potentially can leave in their wills. I was thinking, oh, there's the solution. Just, convert hearts and minds. We're all in it together. Ultimately, we'll serve you. So that's how we'll supply the money. But that's quite a startling drop, isn't it? Do you have any feelings as to why there is that drop rather than an increase, perhaps?
I don't know what the answer to that is, but the gut feeling is that there is less money, there's less wealth in the population currently. Maybe the wealth is in younger people than it used to be, and people spend much of their savings on care home costs at the end of life as well. I think there's a mixture of things, really.
Well, I mean, in his early weeks in office, the Prime Minister Andy Burnham did say that palliative and social care needs to be fixed before we have the debate about assisted suicide. Obviously, the second reading and vote of the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill will happen on the 11th of September. But what I wanted to ask you, Karen, is in your opinion, what exactly needs to be fixed without telling the Prime Minister what to do necessarily?
I mean, Andy Burnham's wish to fix palliative social care is music to my ears and the ears of all those who are struggling to get the care that they need, where they need it, and when they need it. Some joined-up thinking, good organisation of services, continuity of care, excellent communication, and a flow of sufficient finance to support it would allow those who actually have lots of good ideas as to how things could be better to begin to work on it. And those who need the services then to benefit hugely. There's loads that needs to be done.
Well, we did mention legacies there, but I'm now wondering, and I've had this conversation many times, especially with the Art of Dying Well podcast that I host, but how much of this is down to converting hearts and minds, if you like, or how we as a society view death and dying. Certainly 10 years ago, when I started that podcast, it was taboo. People were hardly talking about death and dying. And then, of course, you got some people, frontline broadcasters, others that were willing to share their journeys, usually a cancer journey. But that, I think, turned the dial a bit. But have we got a little bit more to do as a society, do you think, to look at death and dying in a way that almost says, well, hang on, death and dying's part of life?
Oh, I think you're right. I mean, death and dying have always been taboo subjects in our society, mainly through fear. People don't want to think about that. And despite all the attempts at the end-of-life strategy nearly 20 years ago, that actually has changed little, even though some high-profile people have talked about it. Kath Mannix, in her book With the End in Mind, and her many public talks and media broadcasts, has done much to take some of the fear out of death and dying for some people. But many people just close their ears because it's something that they don't want to hear. So I do think we've got a lot to do to normalize something that is very normal. It's a big issue.
Yeah, I remember talking with Catherine about, the language we use as well. You'd get passed away or,
Yeah,
left us or whatever phrase it might be, because people don't want to say has died.
No, and then often get misunderstood because they're using a phrase that people don't understand means that somebody's died.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, I did want to ask you this, because this is something that you hear a lot, and obviously you've got that specialism in the Northwest in your region. But is quality palliative care something that genuinely is a postcode lottery? Are there areas where really it's very patchy indeed?
I think probably the answer to that is yes, it is patchy. But there are lots of hospice services trying really hard to cover the ground and to try and make sure that people get the services that they can. But they can only do as much as they've got funding for, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now I'm going to ask you one final question, and that is, if you could leave our listeners with one thing to take away, or one and a few supporting points, there's some latitude there, what would that be? What can you leave our listeners with?
The risk is that people feel overwhelmed by the enormity of the crisis and paralyzed into doing nothing. But if Jesus could feed 5,000 with an offering of 5 loaves and 2 fish, then our best offering can never be too small to be helpful and useful, and it will be magnified. So love demonstrated in care and compassion for each other is the most important aspect of relationships. If there's something that people think they could do to support their local hospice, for example, a regular weekly donation of £5, the cost of a coffee and a cake, or a gift in their will of 1% of their estate, more if they could afford it. Then, if thousands of people did the same, then hospice and palliative care services will be there for them and for their loved ones when they need them most. No act of generosity is too small. Regardless of what the government is able to do, hospice and palliative care services belong to the people of the area.
And I'm not going to suggest people sidestep tax, but you can be sensible with it. And so if you maybe have a slightly bigger estate, giving that amount of money before it's sort of judged for inheritance tax might leave it quite neutral, but give a very worthwhile gift to a hospice to help it survive.
Absolutely. For those who have more significant assets, then taking advice, financial advice about ways of giving is really worthwhile.
See, I said a final question. I'm adding two more. So my final question is, what would you say to people that still have that view of, oh, I don't even want to open the door of a hospice, or I don't want to go in there, I'm going there to die. It's all very negative. It's very, this is going to be, really uncomfortable for me. Because in my experience, when I've opened the door, I mean, I have been lucky, I have to say, I've gone into hospices that have been wonderfully light, positive, not feeling clinical at all, feeling homely, community-wise, all those things. And I'm not saying that happens everywhere. But what would you say, for instance, about Queen's Court, if someone's like, oh, I don't really fancy opening the door there, what would you say to them?
I would say go and have a look because people are frightened of what they don't understand and what they don't see, and their imagination sort of runs riot for them. But the vast majority of people who go into a hospice, either as a patient, an outpatient, a relative, a visitor, somebody who's bringing in donations, will be really surprised at the atmosphere, the laughter, the geniality, just the whole place, really. It's there for the people who need that care.
Dr. Karen Groves, thank you so much for opening our eyes to the situation, what challenges are being faced, but also the great love, community and joy that can be felt in our hospices. Thank you very much.
Thank you.